everybody part of the Greek supporters playing for a goal. Second to take. The 93rd minute at Old Trafford.
Welcome to TWT FM, a weekly podcast from the world transformed, bringing year-round radical political education and utopian thinking to bear on the issues that define our world. In our second series, we're exploring the concept of leisure, and in particular, aspects of life we've been missing due to the COVID crisis. What does leisure time reveal about our relationship to work and time under capitalism, and how our lives might be different with access to more of it? Join us as we delve into our favourite leisure activities, including football, holidays and more, with the wide-angle lens you'd expect from TWT. As ever, please subscribe and share the podcast with friends if you haven't already. For now though, turn up your headphones, sit back and listen up. This is The World Transformed.
When Karl Marx talked in utopian terms, he talked about a world in which we might fish in the afternoon, rear cattle in the evening, and criticise after dinner. Marx was writing prior to the mass consumption of live football, though. If he was writing today, the example of after-dinner activity he might have used may have been arguing about World Cup squads, picking Fantasy League teams, or playing FIFA. My name's Tom Williams, and I'm a TWT organiser and a lifelong Southampton supporter. For many people, live football has been one of the most keenly felt absences during the pandemic. My dad always says the best thing about football is the head-exploding moments. And what he means by that is basically collective joy, something TWT always tries to build into even its most serious and vital organising work. If you want to see what collective joy looks like, watch some away supporters celebrating a goal. There's nothing quite like the abandon of away fans celebrating. It can be hard to appreciate it because when you see it live, it tends to be from the home end after your team's just conceded a goal. But watching thousands of bodies all cavorting like fireworks in unconfined and uncontainable elation is an amazing sight. Almost the whole point of football fandom is to collectively experience those highs that then pass into a sort of communal memory. But that communal aspect has been taken away by the coronavirus crisis. Sooner or later, fans will return to stadiums, and a rich tradition of cultural life, particularly working class life, can be resumed. But when did this begin? When and how did watching 22 people kicking a bag of wind become such a part of cultural life? We asked David Goldblatt, writer, sociologist, football historian, and, as you'll soon find out, raconteur, to give us a potted history of the fans' experience of the beautiful game.
Everybody say, hey!
If you want to understand the origins of football fandom, then you need to go to 19th century England and Scotland, to the last quarter of the century. But before it became a mass and predominantly working class phenomena in the late 19th century, it's worth going to the 1872 FA Cup final, which was the first to be held. And you might have thought that football fandom, had you been there, was the preserve of the upper classes, held at the Oval, played between a team of old Etonians and old Harrovians. It was like part of the summer society's summer circuit in London. You know, you would go to balls and cricket matches and tea parties, and you'd go to the FA Cup final. And, you know, there were picnics and ladies, you know, with sun umbrellas and parasols. So football at that moment is still a kind of, you know, slightly strange upper class athletic cult, and not a mass phenomena. Fast forward 25 years to the early part of the 20th century, and the FA Cup final, now played between exclusively working class and professional teams, is attracting crowds to the old Crystal Palace in the region of 100,000, and they are overwhelmingly working class in their roots. So something extraordinary has happened in that intervening 25 years. We find that football codified in 1863 played predominantly as an upper class hobby through the 1860s and early 1870s is moving through the class spectrum at lightning speed in the 1870s. First of all to middle class schools and grammar schools, aping their betters in the public schools, but also into the teaching colleges and priest colleges and seminaries, where it's seen immediately as a device for connecting with working class communities. And then there's just a lot of people seeing this game and going, I want to play. And by the 1880s, you know, these working class organizations that have sprung from Sunday schools, from factories, from railway yards, you know, from friends meeting down the pub, are beginning to attract people. Even like 1881, 82, you're getting Blackburn Olympic is pulling 5,000-6,000 people, and people have worked out not only that, but if you put up a fence and a turnstile, people will actually pay to get in. So what's going on? You know, on the one hand, it's something about football, isn't it? I mean, imagine a world without football. My God, how boring. And suddenly football comes along, and this extraordinary game of flow, of excitement, of physicality, of speed, of uncertainty, is in the in your midst. People want to watch this. And working class men in particular have got a bit more time and a bit more money. After the kind of Great Depression of the early 1870s, this is an era where working time is decreasing. People, you know, through trade union action, have won the half-day holiday on Saturdays, because people used to work Saturdays. And that's why, of course, football games happen at 3 o'clock on a Saturday, because people were working until lunchtime a lot of the time. Then you would go to the game after lunch. And there is just football fever. It's the only way to sort of describe it. So fandom is a product really of working class England and Scotland in the 1870s, 80s and 90s. It becomes something more though than just consumption or form of escapism. I think at a very early stage, it becomes a place in which identities are invented, modulated, reproduced and learnt. I mean, we see that as, you know, as early as the early 1880s, when Blackburn Olympic, a working class and effectively professional team from the north of England, play the Old Etonians in the FA Cup final. You know, it's a huge day out for the crowd. You know, many people going to London for the first time in their lives. And you can see from the photographs and the records that people are expressing who they are. We're from Blackburn, we're from the north. And this is our moment in the national spotlight, you know, vis-a-vis the Old Etonians. And I think, you know, by the time you get to the late 1880s, football clubs are such central elements of urban working class communities. And in the absence often of other institutions that would create neighbourhood identities in quite the same way, you have that kind of fandom, that kind of connection that fandom has. And that just keeps on growing in England and Scotland up until the First World War. Since then, I suppose the sort of next stages or versions of fandom really begin to appear in Latin America in the 1930s and 1940s, and particularly in Argentina and Brazil. European football fandom, I think, begins to change in the 1960s and 1970s. Hitherto, you know, through the middle years of the 20th century, the model that emerged in England and Scotland of large, overwhelmingly but not exclusively, male working class crowds standing at behind the goals.
See, after a while, it all gets mixed up together in your head. You can't remember whether life's shit because Arsenal is shit or the other way around. I've been to watch far too many games, spent too much money. fretted about Arsenal when I should have been fretting about something else. I've asked too much of the people I love. Okay, I accept all that. But, I don't know, perhaps it's something you can't understand unless you belong.
It's worth remembering, though, that people actually weren't as obsessive as you might imagine, or at least single-minded. I mean, Nick Hornby's model of, you know, you have one team, it's one team forever, you can't possibly leave them, you only focused on them, etc., which is a trope in all football writing and thinking, is, I think, much less true, certainly of England in the 1950s. I know a lot of people in Bristol who would have gone to see, you know, or their fathers would have gone to see Bristol Rovers one week, but then would have gone to see Bristol City the next week. So it's more, you know, the past is always more complex than our stereotypes. But it is that predominantly self-policing male working class crowd. And then in the 1960s and 1970s, stuff starts to change. I mean, the narrative in England and Scotland is that crowds are in serious decline. Stadiums are in serious decline. There's more space, sort of, if you like, psychically, emotionally and physically for unaccompanied teenagers to show up. And, you know, there was always a bit of argy-bargy, as they say. But you get a space in which masculinity and violence of the younger generation and the whole kind of adrenaline thrill of hooliganism really starts to take root in England for the next 15, 20 years. And while, you know, these folks are never more than a tiny percentage actually of the crowd, their capacity to shape the perception of the game as well as the experience of it in the stadium is actually very profound. Simultaneously with the rise of hooligan gangs in Northern Europe, we have the emergence of ultra culture in Italy in the late 1960s and early 1970s, where a similar demographic of unaccompanied young people with a kind of, you know, adrenaline addiction intensity about football and about their clubs start organising themselves to make their presence felt in the stadium. So there's a whole range of football fandoms going on prior to the contemporary era. Campionato di calcio italiano.
So what is the experience of football fandom in the contemporary era? How does it feel to be a football fan now? Well, for one thing, it feels expensive, because it is expensive. You'll do well to keep the cost of a day at the football up to under 100 quid now, and even watching on the telly is expensive if you want to do it legally, because you have to either pay for some sort of digital subscription or watch it in a pub where you'd be expected to buy drinks. You're much less likely to see your team win a major trophy if you don't support one of the big clubs now. And football is quieter, whether it's because of weird kickoff times or because the grounds are full of tourists, I'm not sure, but there doesn't seem to be quite the same intensity in the stands now. Plus, football fandom now is much more likely to be something you partake in alone. As a lifelong Saints fan, which, along with having been a teenage Marxist, means I'm used to losing, I've gone from experiencing the euphoria of us beating world champions Liverpool to being crushed 9-0 by Manchester United. The win over Liverpool felt less special because I couldn't share it with my dad, because he's locked in his house and I'm locked in mine, while the 9-0 felt even worse than it otherwise would have because he wasn't there to commiserate with. Now, for some people, that's just how they've always experienced and consumed football. There are loads of people who are fans of football clubs in cities they've never visited, and they follow those clubs not even on the telly in a pub, but on their tellies or computers at home. And there are loads of good reasons for this. The cost of live, top-level football is prohibitive, for one. But there are other structural barriers. I mentioned my dad earlier. He's my stepdad, technically, but football really glued us together as father and son and helped me through the estrangement of my birth father. Who knows, perhaps this demonstrates that football is something that can overcome normative notions of the nuclear family. Football is often a father-son thing, though. And if it was more inclusive, then wouldn't that specialness of football in a relationship be more commonly extended to other types of relationship? The reality now, though, is that football grounds aren't always very welcoming, friendly spaces, particularly to women, LGBT people and people of colour. We spoke to Labour Transformed's Viv Soni about his experience of football fandom as a person of colour.
Being from a South Asian family background gives you a very different attitude to football in a way, because quite often we're told that the reason you don't have many South Asians playing at a high level in football is because that's just not the cultural values that South Asians have. So you're always prodded towards other careers by your parents and things like that. And there's probably some truth to that, but then that doesn't really explore the underlying reason why parents push you towards other things. And part of that is likely to be a self-fulfilling prophecy in the sense that there's a complete absence of South Asian representation in football, and therefore it seems unlikely that there ever will be. The aspects of racism within football are quite complicated because it's not in so much overt racism that we've certainly seen flare up in the last year or so, but there's always been a more insidious undertone. I think from my personal experience, there is always a corner of my brain that cannot budge from the knowledge that this is ultimately a white person's sport in this country. And that's very much a feeling and an opinion that's formed by experience, both from the more overt treatment we're seeing now, particularly of black footballers, and as I already mentioned, the complete absence of South Asian footballers. But also, you get these slightly suspicious glances from fellow fans in pubs around the ground. You have people constantly asking you how long you've been going to the football. It feels like a form of policing identity in a way. And I think football raises some really interesting questions around like borderland cases of, I guess you'd call it, symbolic kinship. Football has these shared aspects that are material enough, like common language and experience. You've been going to the same ground with the same people for year on year on year, and your father has been doing that, and your forefathers, what have you. And the idea of these, it's that same, like, slightly Little Englander vibe that you get, where the idea of someone who's doesn't fit into that, like, intuitive identity that you can grasp instantly is to be treated with some suspicion. And again, quite often this doesn't come across in any sort of aggressive manner. It's friendly enough questioning, but the undertone is, like, it's very much there. And of course, once you're aware of that, then it reinforces, because every time you are asked those sorts of questions, you know where they're coming from. So the example I always come back to is a few years ago on my birthday, we were playing Real Madrid at the Lane, and we were on our way. So I think there was four of us, three of us South Asian, one is white, and we're just on the train, just having a chat about the football, and some other guys obviously going to the game, sat there kind of watching us the entire time, just very much aware that you're being watched without anything beyond that. And then perhaps after having been listening in for about 40 minutes, we're getting off the train soon, he gets up, smaller than all of us, he's about, must be in his late 60s, and just without any way of introduction, just asks, so how long have you been going to the football? And one of the things that comes out of that is just to have the sheer confidence, the belief in your own sense of identity and how you identify with this football club, that you feel that you can just approach complete strangers in that way as a representative of that identity, and question their loyalty towards it. I think that sort of confidence comes out of having this entrenched idea of what being a football fan should be. And once you start looking at that, then you realise that it doesn't matter how long you go to the football for, it doesn't matter how many of these shared experiences you have, there is something specific, and in this case, it is the colour of your skin, that means you will not be part of that identity entirely.
Viv Soni there giving us a person of colour's insight into the experience of watching football, and specifically watching Tottenham. And we spoke to another Tottenham supporter, Jane Connor, about her experiences as a fan. Jane was an integral part of the famous Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners and Lesbians Against Pit Closures campaign groups, which feature in the film Pride. We asked her about her journey as a football supporter and why the game is worth fighting for.
I'm Jane, and or Jane Connor. I'm a, oh God, I hate to say this, I'm an older woman. I'm not that old, but I live in North East London. I'm a Labour Party member, I'm an activist, and I support Tottenham Hotspur. I lived in Manchester during the miners' strike, and I got involved in Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners. So I was a sort of an original, not a founding member, but a sort of original, genuine member of Lesbian and Gay Support the Miners. So mostly in active in Manchester at the time, where there was a branch of Lesbian and Gay Support the Miners. But I was also quite involved in supporting women against pit closures during the miners' strike. And for me, that's also like really linked into the football, because I really liked football as a child. I don't quite know why, because we weren't a sporty family. There wasn't any big sort of tradition about a football. I can't claim that, you know, my granddad played for Manchester United or anything like that. Far from it. But for some reason, I quite liked it, and I think my dad quite liked it, and he liked the idea of having somebody in the family who kind of wanted to go to football. So he took me. So we started going to see Leeds United in the early 70s, and that's how I got into it. So I think, it probably looking back, it was because my dad liked the idea of somebody to go with. And also, I probably was a bit of a it's interesting how language changed, so I would have been described as a tomboy back in the day. I'd now be described as gender fluid, but back in the day, and that seemed, it was great. There was something for me quite exciting about actually going into this environment where, you know, it was actually very male. And it's not that I wanted to be a boy at all. It wasn't that at all. But it was fine. It didn't seem unusual for me. I didn't feel uncomfortable in that, partly because a lot of the time, actually, people thought I was a boy anyway. I just had, you know, had short hair and so on. And I was regularly mistaken for being a boy. I didn't feel uncomfortable. But what happened one time was, I mean, this is kind of at the height of football, in inverted commas, hooliganism. And we went to a game, I think it's against Leeds versus Sunderland, and the crowd violence was kind of at another level. We saw there was a Sunderland coach with the fans on, and Leeds fans trying to sort of push it over, and the police were kind of running riot as well. And at that point, my dad said, "No, I can't take you anymore, Jane. Sorry, it's too dangerous." I moved back to London after the miners' strike. I was actually living in Tottenham, and I sort of re-engaged with football, I suppose, or I kind of rediscovered it. I'd fallen out of love with football. So, and it is absolutely the moment at which I kind of discovered socialism and feminism when I was about 16. And I don't know, it just like, it somehow it all went. It seemed completely incompatible. Liking football for me at 16 as a newly kind of emerging socialist feminist seemed completely incompatible. It just seemed somehow wrong, and probably a bit of kind of diversionary from the struggle and so on. I didn't really think about it that much, but I think I fell out of love with it, and it stopped being kind of any part of my life for a few years. But after the miners' strike, I came back to London, moved back to London, and I was living in Tottenham, and you could just you could feel it there. You know, we had a football ground literally up the road, probably about, I don't know, 3/4 of a mile from where I lived. It was very, even then, I mean, it massively dominates now the area. It does look like a spaceship, the new stadium, but you could kind of see it from everywhere. And then, as I say, my friend Vince was a really big Tottenham fan. I mean, he'd been to pretty much every game during the double winning season and so on, you know. And then I met somebody who turned out to be my life partner, and he was quite into football, didn't particularly support anybody, and he just sort of suggested, oh well, why don't we, you know, we could just go to the football. So we went to a game, and oh God, it was amazing. And then, you know, so I said to Vince, we went Spurs. Do you want to come next time? So Vince then came next time. So we'd already got a bit of a group going. And this also coincided, which was, again, I think probably one of the spin-offs from the kind of the miners' strike and the rise of a kind of, you know, sort of lesbian and gay rights movement on the left, was the what was then called the Gay Football Supporters Network had been established. And so actually somebody had put an ad, I don't know if it was in the fanzine, I don't think it was in the programme, but anyway, put an ad somewhere basically calling on, say, you know, are you a gay or lesbian Spurs fan? And actually that brought quite a few people together, and that's formed my sort of group of fans that I went with. So apart from me and my partner and later on my son, they were all lesbians and gay men who were Tottenham supporters. And it was just like brilliant, because you have this bubble, this kind of family to go with. So a lot of it's right, like really linked to me as the kind of the political in that sense. So what happened was there was this kind of intersection between my kind of political activist sort of interests, and then also, which I had loved and I rediscovered in my, I suppose, my late 20s, but rediscovered it in a very different experience, which was going with a group of people who were all out lesbians and gay men. And yes, did experience homophobia in the ground, but would also say that kind of gradually over the years, you know, them taking it on themselves and me perhaps as an ally taking it on, but also the, you know, it changed. And I think mostly they would feel the experience now going to the game, although we haven't actually been to a game for what seems like a very long time, is that actually perhaps other fans would perhaps challenge it now. And also, obviously, the football authorities, that the clubs themselves, for whatever reasons, have decided, you know, as well as, you know, standing up to racism, that are going to stand up to homophobia. So it's a kind of thinking about the difference from the, you know, the mid-80s to now. So it was a moment for me walking into the club shop and seeing there is an official club rainbow football scarf. There's a supporters club, which is a proud lily white, and there's a flag in the, you know, in the ground. And that's they've partly done it, I suppose, for commercial reasons, but also, you know, you do feel, I think you do feel more included. And I felt very proud actually to be a Tottenham fan. It's very similar, actually, being on a mass demonstration with all those people who've got the same kind of purpose, I suppose. It's very similar. That's how I'd describe it. So to being in the Tottenham Stadium with their, you know, 55,000 other people who fundamentally have got, you know, there's the same objective, isn't it, which is to support your team and hope your team wins, is why it's worth it, because it's about solidarity, isn't it? It's about giving people actually an experience as well of solidarity, which you don't always get, and it itself can be a site for struggle. So actually, however inadequately football is tackling racism, actually it's out there, isn't it? And to the same way, also about homophobia as well. So actually then there's a way that you can relate to people and have some of those conversations really as well.
TWT is an annual festival and year-round political education project committed to providing political education across the UK in order to build a movement capable of radically transforming society. TWT relies on you. So head over to theworldtransformed.org to become a supporter.
5 o'clock, time for a very special sports report.
What socialists should want, I think, is for the good bits of football to be shared around a bit more and not just experienced by rich people. We don't want a working class kid from Salford to be priced out of that experience because some hedge fund manager from Oslo wants to keep the experience for themselves. But that is undeniably happening and has been happening for years. This is not me having a pop at Man United fans in Malaysia or Maidstone, but for things to get better, it's probably going to need fans to own their club's shit, frankly. I get annoyed that Liverpool or United can really just take whichever players they want from my club, but by the same token, I don't think it should be a cause for celebration when my lot do that to Plymouth or Leyton Orient. We shouldn't stand for some CEO saying that Leicester have no business in being in the Champions League when they were the champions. Because the natural end point of all this, it seems to me, is everyone supporting one of about six clubs, with the rest either out of business or diminished to the status of barely relevant feeder clubs. When you look at clubs like Bolton and Bury struggling to survive, it's important to understand that each of those clubs is its own community of many thousands of people, and it's been all but destroyed by capital. It's not so far removed from some oligarch destroying a town by sticking an oil pipeline in the middle of it. Socialists shouldn't stand for the biggest clubs stockpiling brilliant young players like Maggie Thatcher stockpiling coal in the Netherlands. But there are obviously important moral dilemmas for left-wingers who love football. We listened in on a conversation between two left-wingers who have written extensively about the complexity of the relationships they have with the game. Juliet Jakes is a writer, filmmaker, and the host of the Sweet 212 podcast, and we think a longer version of this chat will be available on the Sweet 212 Patreon at some point. Joe Kennedy is an author and cultural theorist who's currently working on a new edition of his brilliant book about football, Games Without Frontiers.
Norwich played Liverpool in a really astounding game a few years ago that Liverpool ended up winning 5-4.
I remember that.
Well, I was there, and I think Liverpool went 1-0 up. Norwich went 3-1 up at the beginning of the second half. I turned around to my mate and said, there's far too much of this game left. We're not holding this lead. 30 seconds later, it was 3-2. At the end of normal time, it was 4-3 to Liverpool. And then 2 minutes into injury time, goalscorer extraordinaire Sebastian Bessong leathered in a 20-yard sort of half volley. And rather than everyone kind of sing, you know, On the Ball City's kind of club anthem or whatever, or sing something in praise of their own team, all the fans in the Barclay end behind the goal turned around to the away fans and started singing something like We Pay Your Benefits, something like that. And I was just stood there just yelling like, for fuck's sake, like, shut up. And Liverpool went straight up the other end and scored the winner. And I stood there in the Barclay end thinking, yeah, you kind of deserved that. Which is not a nice way to feel about your own fans, but it's something that happens periodically.
Absolutely. I mean, I wrestle with this a lot of the time because it's, you know, what are people buying into when they sing something like that? And how many people who do kind of, you know, perform this speech act are at the same time people who would, you know, totally disavow that sentiment if you ask them in the street afterwards. It's a kind of strange thing, isn't it? Like what is going on there?
Yeah, and with Liverpool, it's ubiquitous, right? It's as ubiquitous as the sort of homophobic chants against Brighton used to be or whatever. It's unfailing if anyone's playing Liverpool. And, you know, not so much Norwich as a city, but Norfolk as an area is very largely Tory. But that's obviously not true of a lot of the clubs around the top flight. So, yeah, that's something that always makes me feel very awkward and, you know, increasingly kind of upset when I attend a game, you know. I think football sort of fandom, football culture is endlessly about kind of generating memories, is about nostalgia, is about sort of historical rhymes and resonances. And it's really interesting when you see a club move to a new stadium, whether it's Arsenal or Brighton Hove Albion, you'll see these sort of like paintings or murals or whatever outside the ground, kind of, you know, emphasizing the club's history. And it's one thing to see at Arsenal when you see these kind of murals of their great players of the past, kind of arm in arm, you know, so Ted Drake and Cliff Bastin arm in arm with Ian Wright or Thierry Henry or whatever. It's another thing at Brighton when you see a sort of bas relief sort of mural of Leon Knight or something, you know. But that's the schism, isn't it?
I find that that thing on the Emirates Stadium, when everyone going up north, I'll go past it in the train. I find it more moving than I feel like I should do. But it is a kind of flattening thing, isn't it? What I like is, like, you know, Brighton end up with Leon Knight, Arsenal end up with Ian Wright, and yeah, it's a kind of football clubs all do the same thing, and that's likable. But there is always that attempt to kind of sort of be historical. You know, the kind of more dehistoricized something seems to be moving towards being, the more kind of it grasps on the sort of facets or kind of bric-a-brac versions of history.
Yeah, but his history without any analysis of the structural forces that have changed
absolutely.
It. You know, Manchester City will talk all day about, you know, well, it was kind of funny and fun when Jamie Pollock was scoring these sort of performance our own goals and getting us relegated to the third division. But now we have, you know, Sergio Aguero and Guardiola managing us, and, you know, in the whole of football culture, apart from like kind of marginalised grouches like us, you won't find anyone talking about the material conditions. I mean, I noted the other day, you know, the Qatar World Cup, The Guardian had a headline suggesting that as many as 6,500 workers might have died building the stadium.
It's unbelievable,
isn't it? For context, like, one of the higher estimates of Chernobyl deaths is 4,000, which I found absolutely astonishing. And again, it was another one of those things that really made me say to myself, like, ethically, can I support my own passion for football? And like, the World Cup is my favourite thing in the world. Like, I absolutely, you know, once every 4 years, I basically put everything down and just watch the World Cup for a month. And I really don't think I'm going to be able to justify doing that next year.
I think for the first time ever,
I managed to sort of hold my nose for Russia 2018, despite spending the whole tournament in Ukraine, which was boycotting the tournament. But Qatar 2022, I don't know, it's difficult.
I think you meet quite a lot of left-wing people in football, and more than the sort of like popular understanding of football would have you believe. Like, whether that's in playing or in supporting, like, it was, you know, there is, it is one of the places in the UK where you do from time to time surprisingly encounter sort of popular leftism. So there is already something there. I mean, the football clubs, football grounds are kind of contested spaces in that hegemonic sense. I think that, you know, there is already the contest there. They haven't been won over by kind of any argument, but I think in some football clubs, and this is a good start, the left-wing argument does win out. And you can also see that there is a jealousy, maybe is jealousy the right word for it, but of, you know, that other clubs start to feel about fan-owned clubs. And so something like fan-owned clubs is a great way into sort of thinking in sort of relatively left-wing terms, right? You know, okay, it's not an... It's one of those things like UBI or whatever in the wider world that isn't automatically left-wing but has got kind of strong sort of connotations of the left. And, you know, people say to Darlington fans nowadays, we wish that we had what you have. We wish that we were, and to Lewis fans as well. And this is kind of recognition that we, you know, Darlington are never going to be in a position to sign the equivalent of Marco Gabbiadini ever again, I shouldn't think. And Lewis are never going to really kind of get very far in, you know, beyond the Isthmian League or the Conference South if they can make it. But people will still say, we would rather have what you have than we have. So there is a kind of broadening awareness of why that is a good thing.
Yeah. Joe, you and I are both sort of pretty pessimistic people as a kind of natural inclination. So should we end there on a note of optimism?
I think we should do that, shouldn't we? That piece of
never knowingly on brand.
For the fans.
You got to hold and give, but do it at the right time. You can
So what would a utopian vision for football look like? This isn't what I think football would look like in utopia, but an idealised vision for football in late capitalism as something that might help us resist the worst excesses of capitalism, challenge white supremacy, challenge patriarchy, challenge heteronormativity, or even prefigure the end of capitalism. Now, because the interests of different groups of fans are in conflict, because we all want to see our team win, it might be difficult to build solidarity between fan bases. But that's where the left comes in, I think. Just because it's difficult doesn't mean it's impossible, and it doesn't mean we shouldn't try. Football, even big football, football in the Premier League must remain a site of struggle. After all, football has been the theatre of class war in the past. It's just that, unfortunately, there was only one side waging that war. Here's David Goldblatt again.
Why did Thatcher hate football so much? I mean, at one level, she was absolutely and totally uninterested in football or sport. As we know, she was quite kind of one-track person, you know, like politics is what she did. So it really didn't, you know, when she came to power, and I even think amongst, you know, her kind of senior lieutenants, it really wasn't much of an issue. It was forced to be an issue for her in 1985, when you have a televised riot at Luton versus Millwall, and of course the tragedy of the Bradford fire. All of those happen like within, you know, like a month of each other. And at that point, football is absolutely, now it has to be on her agenda. She frames all of those events of, you know, this is another example of the, you know, an uppity working class that needs to be put in its place. You know, these people are the enemy within. This is everything that modern England is not meant to be. And it's the same moment, you know, I think, you know, Thatcher's all about destroying working class industrial England, isn't she? I mean, football's the least of it. They destroy, you know, they destroy most of the inheritance of 45. Council housing decimated. Municipal socialism and local government, you know, decimated, legislated out of existence, nationalised industries, gone. And it's like, okay, what else? Football. And I think that's part of the agenda as well.
David Goldblatt's book, The Ball Is Round, is one of the best books ever written about football and is available in all good left bookshops. I think it's good, both in the moral sense and also in the sense of it being healthy and fun, to go and watch non-league football. And if you're listening to this as one of those fans who does just engage with football on telly or online, I'd encourage you to try and get down to particularly a left-leaning non-league side like Clapton or Whitehawk. But I don't think we should give up on elite-level football one day being inclusive and cheap and solidarity-building and joyful. Ideally, with the joy dished out a bit more equitably than it currently is. Newcastle United are one of the biggest clubs in the land, with one of the most passionate fan bases. Callum Bell is a mental health nurse and now a member of Momentum's National Coordinating Group. Not so long ago, though, he worked for the Labour Party's now defunct Community Organising Unit on an inspiring campaign against the almost comically evil Newcastle United and Sports Direct owner, Mike Ashley.
I think the best way to probably sum up what it brings to the culture of Newcastle is the nickname that we call St James's, which is the cathedral on the hill. There's very few football stadiums that's literally in the heart of the city centre. And that's Newcastle. Any part of Newcastle, you can see it on top of a hill, right in the centre. And it's not just even a city thing with Newcastle. I guess the catchment area of Newcastle United fans spans from the Scottish borders, down through Northumberland, into sort of the Tyneside area, into Newcastle, into Gateshead, parts of Washington, Durham. It's massive. That's sort of, even Northumberland alone is probably a geographical space larger than London. I think in terms of actual culture and the history of Newcastle, it's massive as well. I remember sort of speaking to people about trade unionism within the area and working in mines and working in shipyards, And a part of that was the camaraderie and the, how amazing it was, sort of a sense of belonging within those workplaces. And I think as those industries have become obsolete and non-existent within the Northeast, that sense of community has been fulfilled by being a Newcastle United fan. So Mike Ashley, I guess, moved into the public eye when he took over Newcastle United. Mike Ashley obviously owns Sports Direct and has a very active role within the running of Sports Direct. And Sports Direct's probably more well-known recently in terms of what's happened at Shirebrook, which is sort of its mega warehouse in the Midlands. And I think one of the headlines from sort of an undercover report on the conditions within Shirebrook was essentially describing it like a Victorian workhouse, with stories of a woman giving birth in one of the toilets in the warehouse because she was so scared about taking time off work and she might lose her job. Huge issues with 0-hour contracts and just generally really appalling working conditions. I had the pleasure of working for the community organising unit when it first started up back in 2018. I started in September. When I actually interviewed the person who founded the community organising unit, who was a lead for it within the party, Dan Firth, mentioned the fact that I had a Newcastle United tattoo during the interview. I thought that was a bit odd. Anyway, later down the line, he kept on ringing me about Mike Ashley and about it, agitating me, I guess, to take on that campaign. And eventually we talked about who's the biggest villain in the area where I was working. That's the Northeast, and there isn't a bigger villain than Mike Ashley up here. He's utterly hated, detested by fans, detested by the community. So when we talked about that and talked about just the injustices that happened within Shirebrook and what was happening at Newcastle United at the time, Dan pushed me and said, you've got to do it. So that's what I did. I started reaching out, building relationships with football fans, bringing those relationships together, and sort of we identified that actually this is something that was really ripe to organise around, I guess. So from that, started building up these relationships. This was over summer, and at that time, Rafa Benitez, who's admired up here for his very short time up here, he didn't renew his contract and stepped back and cited Mike Ashley being a massive reason and a lack of ambition and respect for the club, the reason why he was stepping back. And that was sort of, I guess, a catalyst that sort of massively sped up the process of getting people involved, getting people active. And from that, it sort of snowballed into quite a lot of action over that summer. I'll tell you a story about Scott. Scott is someone who has never been particularly active in any campaign work before. He worked in a manufacturing factory, and he was one of the pre-organising meetings that we held. Scott came along and was really, really passionate, really enthusiastic. So I got his name, got his details, and agreed to meet up with him for a cup of tea and a coffee. So we sat down and we got talking, and again, he's like, proper broad Geordie accent, young lad, just absolutely furious at what was going on at the club. Anyway, he was really eager to get involved, and as we were leaving the coffee shop, he turned around and he went, yeah, Cal, are you political and that? And I was like, wait, Scott, I just told you I work for the Labour Party. Of course I am. And he basically then went a huge rant about Brexit and about how Labour haven't listened to her. And yeah, I was really sort of a bit taken back, but he continued turning up, he continued getting involved, and now to see Scott, he's one of the biggest champions for the Labour Party. If you ever see Ian Lay retweet something, he's retweeting, commenting on it. I think this campaign sort of triggered something in his mind about capitalism and about socialism and about what it can do to people's lives and what damage our current capitalist system is doing to people. So yeah, in terms of the wider political nature of the campaign, did open people's eyes. And I think framing the damage that the financialisation of football under capitalism done within communities, it's definitely opened people's eyes. A massive part of the campaign was around conscious raising from my perspective. In terms of seeing football fans who have never got involved with trade unionism, never gotten involved in workers' rights, all of a sudden retweeting and sharing content around sort of what Unite were doing at Shirebrook and getting really annoyed about it, and just saying how unjust it was really, that was one of the first times it sort of triggered me and sort of thinking, actually, in terms of demonstrating the damage that capitalism's doing within our community, football is a very, very interesting way of framing it and making it sort of a little bit more digestible. And then all of a sudden, within the campaign, like I said, we were talking about trade unions, we were talking about injustices, and we're also talking about the power that working class people have within football, because largely football fans are completely powerless within that. So through organising and through doing sort of organising training and like dissecting what power actually looks like and that what power do we have as football fans, I think, like I said, all of a sudden it sort of clicked for a few people around sort of this being just bigger than Newcastle United. Cronyism within Mike Ashley's regime in terms of him asset stripping the club, all of a sudden sort of when it's put in the language of football, it, people, I guess, a little bit more open and talking about politics. And I think most recently, if you look at the protest bill that's just going through Parliament as we're doing this podcast now, I tweeted about that, but framed it purely around protesting of Mike Ashley and framed it around basically talking about how Newcastle United fans are powerless in this, and the only way we can demonstrate our collective anger of this through our right of protest. And if that's taken away, all of a sudden, Mike Ashley has a lot more power within the city. And then sort of, again, sort of that sort of highlighted me again, this just goes further than talking about football in terms of what happens within our city. It's talking about sort of wider political issues and how football can be a vehicle to change, persuade and agitate people and educate people as well. At Durham Miners Gala, one of the lads who's involved with the campaign, Brian, at Geordie Signs, I'm going to give him a plug because he does a hell of a lot of work for her. A group of six or seven of her went to Durham Miners Gala. For the majority of them, it was the first time they've ever been to a political event like that. And then we stood in the crowd with our banner, and we got some photos with some lefty MPs from the North East, Ian Lavery, Ian Mearns, got some photographs of them to promote the campaign that we're doing. And then in the middle of Jeremy Corbyn's speech that we're sitting listening to, he mentioned Mike Ashley and talked about the damage that people like Mike Ashley are doing to our communities. So I looked around at the lads' faces, and honestly, their face just lit up when he started mentioning it, and they were jumping up and down, shouting, screaming about it. And it was honestly just a fantastic moment for it. The North East's got a real issue with fascism in the far right up here. This goes back sort of generations, really. Oswald Mosley had a very active black shirts group up here. I think we even had headquarters in the big market in Newcastle at one point as well. EDL were very prevalent, the BNP as well. And Pegida in 2015 held their first UK rally in the North East. And I remember I went to that as an anti-racist and an anti-fascist, and I went to that, and the city was far more anti-racist and anti-fascist their campaign against Pegida. It was really quite pathetic on their part. And then a bloke who I didn't know at the time, but I do know now, Bill Corcoran, who runs the Football Fan Food Bank, got on stage, and he's a tower of a man. He's a giant of a figure, just huge bloke. And he, wearing a Newcastle United strip, got on stage with a microphone of a PA, and he just started chanting, "Newcastle United will never be defeated." And at that moment, just the crowd erupted, chanting something that I've only ever heard being chanted in the terraces at the Gallagher end at St. James's Park, all of a sudden just ringing around the city from anti-racists and anti-fascists. It was honestly one of the most powerful moments in my life.
Newcastle United will never be defeated! my senses, like a gallon of magnet, like a packet of woodbines, like a good pinch of snuff, like a night out in Sheffield, like a greasy chip butty, like Sheffield United, come thrill me again, na 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 na, ooh.
For all the against modern football stuff, which often seems pretty revanchist and reactionary anyway, it's important to keep in mind that while, yes, capitalism is always trying to expand into football and find new ways of monetizing it, capital hasn't won football. Not yet. It doesn't have a dominant, unquestioned hegemony over the game. The sepia-tinted defeatism of many fans is misplaced. For starters, football is absolutely terrible for turning surplus value into profit. Even Manchester United wouldn't get anywhere near the FTSE 250. The book Soconomics talks about an obscure company in Dundee that makes conveyor belts, then tells you that its annual turnover is three times that of Real Madrid. Football is also potentially an important vehicle for explaining why conservatism and liberalism, ideologies which are intrinsically about protecting private property, are not just bad for football, undergirding as they do the likelihood of your club being legally owned by some nutter with a load of petrodollars, but bad full stop, in that they fundamentally oppose collectivity and commonality, without which we can't experience that big head-exploding moment, or luxuriate in its memory decades later. We support collective ownership, so why let football be privatised? Is it even possible to own, for example, a goal? Does the person who scored it even own it, when it's experienced subjectively, but also collectively, by thousands of other people? Football demonstrates that consumerism and commercialism have limits, and it demonstrates the potential for collective power to impose limits. It should only divide us for 90 minutes at a time. The rest of the time it should bring us together. Why can't we try to set up a socialist society around every club? It could be a brilliant way of connecting and galvanising the left, and then every fixture could be an opportunity to create networks of intellectual exchange. Yeah, I'll be pissed off if your team beats mine, but that doesn't mean we can't have a drink afterwards and compare notes on radical organising. That's not to mention that, as David Goldblatt suggested earlier, live football comes with the potential for civil disobedience on a fairly grand scale. Football can be radicalised, and it can be radicalising, exposing as it does what capitalists seek to do to community assets. Because that, really, is what a football club is. A community.
We're grateful to Autonomy for their support in making this series. To find out about their planning for the future of work, and hence what our leisure time will look like, head to autonomy.work. TWT is committed to providing radical political education to build a world transformed, but we need your help. So please subscribe to this podcast, tell your friends, and consider becoming a supporter of the organisation by visiting theworldtransformed.org. Together, we can imagine, demand, and build a world transformed.
Queen's Park Rangers 1, Preston North End 2, Cardiff City 1, Reading 3, Hull City 1, Sheffield United 2, Millwall 2, Southampton Town 3, Leeds United 4.